This podcast is brought to you in part by Contact My Politician, a free, fast way to find your local and national politicians and to keep them accountable. Click on their banner at our website, michaelmedved.com.
From pop culture to politics, this is The Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when that big recount in Georgia is moving forward toward its conclusion. And as a matter of fact, they found 2,600 ballots that had not been counted in a county that's very favorable to President Trump, Fulton County. And those ballots now have been added to the mix. President Trump has gained about 800 votes. It still means he's 13,000 votes behind, which, just to put it in perspective, means that he's about 25. The gap is 25 times larger than was the famous gap between Al Gore and George Bush in Florida in 2000. The other difference, of course, is that even if through some miracle President Trump was able to swing the votes in Georgia, which we'll probably know about before the end of the show today, because they're supposed to be concluding this recount and they've been keeping people abreast of what's developing. Even if President Trump, through a recount, ends up carrying the vote in Georgia, which is unlikely but conceivable, if that happened, he would still be a major distance from actually undoing the presidential race. Where, as it stands right now, it would be 306 electoral votes for Joe Biden and 232 for President Trump. And that's where we stand on that. But what it indicates, of course, is that this is a very closely divided country. It was a closely divided election. Why are the divisions in America so much harder and tougher, it appears, than they are in other countries? Is it something about the issues, or is it something about our political structure? There's an interesting piece by Pew Research. There is also a very interesting piece, of all places, in the New York Times, which suggests that the Democratic dream of riding demographic change into total dominance they had at the beginning of this century. Way back in 2002, there was an influential book that came out that was called The Emerging Democratic Majority that said that because the numbers of Asian Americans in particular and Latino Americans in particular were increasing so dramatically, that there would be firm, overwhelming, dominant democratic control of everything, everywhere, as far as the eye can see. Hasn't worked that way. Why not? It's actually the New York Times gives a pretty good answer why. And there is a bear problem. No, I'm serious. I'm not talking about Wall Street, even though the market was down a little bit today, not disastrously. But no, there's a bear problem with brown bears that are eating people and attacking people. And apparently the only way to ward them off is with mechanical wolves. This is not a joke. It is real. We'll tell you where later on the Medved Show. And there's an amazing story about a rescue that it seems to me shows some of the best in America that is worth celebrating, and some of the worst in America that is not worth celebrating, an attempt to censor, literally to take it off shelves and to actually burn it, to burn a book. What is the book about that makes it so controversial? We'll speak to its author, Abigail Schreier, a little bit later in this show, because it's pretty remarkable in this day and age to write something that is so seriously opposed to political correctness that there are so-called responsible, prominent commentators who are saying, hey, you should steal the book and then put it on big piles and burn it. Really? We will get to that as well on a busy day on the Medved show. Okay, first off, there is a this truly shocking admission in the New York Times that and they put it on the front page that the Democrats' dream of achieving total electoral dominance by putting together wealthy white liberals with all kinds of people who are black and Asian and Latino and all people of color, that that dream fell apart in this election. And yes, Biden won with overwhelming support from non-white communities, but it wasn't as overwhelming as Democrats assumed it would be. Why not? Well, they give a very good example here, starting in California, of all places, which is supposed to be, of course, the left-wing liberal heartland in this country. And Michael Powell writes in the Times, the proposition seemed tailor-made for one of the nation's most diverse and liberal states, California. Officials asked voters to overturn a 24-year-old constitutional ban on affirmative action in education, employment, and contracting. It's really a ban on preferential treatment, and that's what it specifically forbids, but we'll let the word pass. The state political and cultural establishment worked as one to pass the ballot measure. That is, bringing back affirmative action, bringing back preferential treatment for people of color. The governor, a senator, members of Congress, university professors, and civil rights leaders called it a righting of old wrongs. The Los Angeles Times wrote an editorial endorsement, and the editorial endorsement said women and people of color are still at a sharp disadvantage by almost every measure. Yet on election day, the proposition failed. As a matter of fact, it was crushed. You know what the margin was? The concluding margin was 57 to 43. That's called a landslide. And Latino and particularly Asian American voters played a key role in defeating it. The outcome captured the gap between the vision laid out by the liberal establishment in California, which has long imagined the creation of a multiracial, multi-ethnic coalition that would embrace progressive causes, and the real on-the-ground sentiments of many Black, Latino, Asian, and Arab voters. This is very encouraging for conservatives, and it seems to me it's very much worthy of attention. They cite Omar Wasow, who's been a guest on this show, who's a Black professor at Princeton University, who says, we should not think of demographics as destiny. He said, these groups are far more heterogeneous, or far more different among themselves than a monolith, and campaigns often end up building their own idiosyncratic coalition. Asian American Californians opposed the affirmative action measure in large numbers. A striking number of East and South Asian students have gained admission to elite state universities. That means mostly people whose ancestors are from China, Japan, or India, or Pakistan for that matter. These groups are far more heterogeneous, he says, and they continue to say that their families of the East Asian and South Asian students, their families spoke to reporters of their fear that their children would suffer if merit in college and college admissions was given less weight. Why should anyone be against merit as a consideration for getting into schools? I mean, the whole point of putting those people in jail and prosecuting all of them is they were trying to use bribes. They were trying to go beyond merit to fake resumes. That, of course, is unsupportable. Latinos, too, appear sharply divided. Prominent Latino nonprofit and civil rights organizations endorsed the affirmative action proposition, even as all 14 of California's majority Latino counties voted it down. Why'd they vote it down? We will get to that and the true nature of the political divide in America and more coming up on the MedVed Show. This piece in the New York Times about how it happened that Asian Americans and Latino Americans, Hispanic Americans, who, of course, neither one, Asians are very different from one another. People of Korean heritage are not identical or mistaken or replaceable concerning regarding South Asians, people who might be from India or Sri Lanka. There are literally billions of people. What is it? I think about 4 billion people total in Asia. And it represents all kinds of different cultures and heritage. And the same is true, of course, of Latino people. I mean, there are Latino people from Latin America. One of the people who's being boosted as a candidate for the U.S. Senate to replace Kamala Harris when Governor Newsom makes an appointment in California to replace Kamala Harris when she becomes vice president. One of those people is born in Peru. It's a mayor of Long Beach. And Peru is very different from El Salvador, which is very different from Mexico. So part of what they're finding out, Democrats, is that there are very, very big differences between people who are from Puerto Rico and people who may be from Honduras. It's a different cultures. And they have in common a linguistic heritage, but not even really an ethnic heritage. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about lots of people in California who looked at the University of California, where the largest group of admittees in the University of California has been Asian. The second largest group of admittees has been Latino. Whites are third. And people were looking at that and saying, wait a minute. We're doing pretty well in terms of getting into the University of California and moving ahead financially. And that is certainly true of Asians and Latinos overwhelmingly in the Golden State in California, which is why in the 14 Latino majority counties, they voted by crushing majorities to reject this pro-affirmative action, this pro-race-based preferences initiative that was on the ballot in California, and that lost overall by 57-43. It just crushed the liberal establishment. And Lanhee Chen is cited by the New York Times. He's been a frequent guest on the show. He's a friend. He's a fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He says there's more texture to California blue politics than you might think. Identity politics only goes so far. There's a sense on affirmative action that people resent being characterized by progressives. Latinos make up more than half the population of San Bernardino County, although significantly fewer turn out to vote. More residents there voted on the affirmative action proposition than voted on the presidential race. They really cared about it. And they rejected, and this is a majority Latino county, they rejected the proposition by 28 points. I mean, just killed it. Hated it. This is extraordinarily important. In rural Imperial County, in the northeastern corner of the state, 85% of the population is Latino. The voters there who gave Joe Biden a 27-point margin of victory, they went against the affirmative action nonsense by 16 percentage points. In other words, the Democratic Party officially endorsed this loser of a proposition. And yet these people over Imperial County in the southeastern corner of the state, it's very hot out there, they split between voting yes for Biden, but voting no overwhelmingly on this proposition. This is a very, very important recognition that, and more people voted on the proposition than voted on the presidential race. Since the dawn of this century, the 21st century, it has become commonplace for Democratic Party leaders to talk of a rising demographic tide that is destined to lift the Democrats to dominance. That liberal coalition is seen as resting on a bedrock of upper middle-class white voters alongside working and middle-class Black, Latino, and Asian voters. But one of the guys who put together that book, The Emerging Democratic Majority, years ago in 2002, John Judas, says, hey, guess what? This doesn't work today. This isn't working. It's not the reality. People of color, says John Judas, is a term that's been adopted by the cultural left as a way of arguing that if these groups proportionally voted Democratic in the past, they will do so in the future. I don't see how you can make that argument, particularly after this election. The New York Times writes, in Texas and Florida, in California, and even in Colorado, where exit polls found that roughly 40% of the white voters and 38% of Latino voters cast ballots for President Trump. Now, follow that for a moment. In Colorado, which used to be a swing state, you had virtually identical percentages of Latinos and whites who voted for Trump. Now, it was a minority in both cases. However, what that indicates is the problem for President Trump in Colorado was not Latino voters. He did very well. He got 38%, is very competitive. The problem was with white suburban voters, which is why Biden carried Colorado fairly easily. But all of this is so important, and it seems to me so encouraging, because the whole idea of classifying people based on skin color and assuming that you can only be a real Black, that was one of the worst things Biden said in the whole campaign. He said, if you're Black in, remember when he was on with Charlemagne the God on the radio? And he said, if you're Black and you don't vote for me, you ain't Black. I mean, really? The idea that the shade of your skin should dictate how you vote is obnoxious. And frankly, it's un-American. And the idea that more and more people are kind of recognizing that is a very profoundly important development. In California, the sands of change blow in varying directions, writes the New York Times. In 2018, Democrats swept the Orange County congressional seats. In 2020, the Republicans have rebounded and taken at least two of those seats. By the way, Republicans took another seat with a Black Republican conservative candidate who's been a frequent guest on this show. He's been on three times. And Burgess Owens. It's a close race. He knocked off the Democratic incumbent, Ben McAdams, and he will be a new Republican congressman from Utah. Black Republican congressman. This is the future, America, not sorting people based upon race, and not sorting them at all, letting individuals make choices. We'll be right back on the Medved Show.
Whatever process exists, one side accepts that they have lost whatever process has happened. What makes the U.S. system so interesting is that because it's so intricate and so involved and goes over such a long period of time for the presidency, is that the president, or is that there are so many actors who are involved in this process, and there's a lot of different junctures at which a concession can be reached, that it's not just, you know, an election commission announces the result and then the president has to decide whether or not to accept it. No, it's a big, long process, and there's a lot of different people involved.
And you make the point, and I think it's something that's very much worth thinking about, is in politics, as in warfare, there really are only two ways that things get settled. Either one side concedes, surrenders, or you keep fighting until one side is completely destroyed, or both are completely destroyed. You praise what a lot of people see as a rickety, outmoded system in America, because it gives a multiple participants the opportunity to make their will felt in this process of concession. Explain how that works.
So any U.S. election, it takes place in two stages. So one, you have the vote counting stage at all the different in all the different states, in which you have lots of state officials involved in counting the votes. All of the states will have their own rules as to how challenges can be pursued, and then eventually the electors will meet in mid-December, will cast their ballots. The governor will certify those as the true result from their state. And then, so there's a lot of different places at which different people are involved and different people can make the decision to give up on behalf of their party. So in Florida or in Georgia, for example, if Biden's lead holds in Georgia, Brian Kemp is going to have to decide whether he's going to sign the electoral votes, as he's legally obliged to do. And then Congress counts the votes on January the 6th. And there's a whole process there if electoral votes are disputed. Any challenge would go to each house of Congress. And even if one, the houses are controlled by different parties, there's still an opportunity for a concession. So at this point in the process, we've already had four Republican senators congratulate Joe Biden on his victory. And so that's already rules out a challenge at that level.
Do you think there is any real chance that President Trump will refuse to concede during the entire period leading up to the Electoral College of votes being submitted in December?
I think it's really possible. That's up for him to decide. It looks like he's not willing to do that now, whether that changes over the next month. I mean, this is a slow process. There's a lot of time for temperatures to cool and sanity to prevail. So possibly by mid-December, he'd be willing to do that. But certainly at the moment, there's no sign of a willingness to do that.
Okay, if he doesn't, then how do you think it works? Let's assume the president has not conceded. He has actually lost the election. Am I right that the votes are supposed to be submitted to the Congress and then counted by the vice president in the presence of both the House and the Senate? Isn't that what the 12th mm-hmm. Amendment says?
Yep, that's absolutely right.
So how does that work? I mean, if President Trump says, no, I didn't lose.
Well, so that process happens regardless of what the president says. So the electors will meet in their various state capitals and cast their ballots. The governors will certify those, and those will be forwarded to the Capitol. I mean, what remains to be seen is whether they any shenanigans get attempted. So, for example, something that could be tried would be to congregate President Trump's electors, his nominated electors that have been defeated in these various states, and try to have them vote anyway on the day that the electors cast their ballots and submit them to Congress in order to create a contest that Congress would have to determine. Whether there's the willingness to do this, either among the electors or among anyone in these state governments to try to bless or certify these results in some way, we don't know. But depending on how far the president and his allies and his party are willing to push this, because the president can't do this by himself. He needs people to press this claim at every step in the process in order for it to have any chance of getting even through to the count on January 6th.
Okay, this has only happened once before in American history, in 1876, where there were different slates of electors submitted for three different states. And in that occasion, they created an electoral commission with members of the House, members of the Senate, and members of the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this could end up with the same kind of impromptu solution?
Probably not. I mean, it depends on whether Congress were to agree to change if they wanted to create such a process. Congress.
The Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com.
Michael Medved Show, in the middle of this furious and ferocious election season, we all are thinking about who it is we're going to put into office at various levels, local, federal, state levels, county levels. But there's a problem. And the problem is a lot of Americans, including those who are very passionate about politics, spend a lot of time figuring out who we're going to elect and then who we're going to re-elect or not. But in between, when there's governing going on, we often let it go. It's one of the reasons I'm so proud to be associated with ContactMyPolitician.com, because this is an organization which exists basically to keep you in touch with the people that you choose to elect so that you can hold their feet to the fire, you can stay in touch with what they're doing, and continue to make your voice heard in between elections. The chief operating officer and director of the company is Steve Katzman, who joins me now. And Steve, I thought maybe you could share with listeners a quick account of how ContactMyPolitician.com got started. What was the point? How did it happen?
Sure, I appreciate that, Michael. And just so everyone's aware, I'm the founder. I do have someone who runs the day-to-day operations of ContactMyPolitician.com. With that being said, really started 5 years ago, and it was really a cross-section between three things that got me to the point of creating Contact My Politician. And it was really based on my experience as a direct marketer practicing one-to-one marketing. Been doing that my entire life with consumers. It was my passion for politics and finding myself on my ride to and from work or listening to the radio or watching the news and hearing politicians state their positions. And when I would hear politicians that I clearly didn't agree with, I'd find myself yelling back at the radio or the TV, screaming and explaining to them why I thought what they were saying wasn't accurate or why I didn't agree with it. And the thing that really tipped it over was I had an uncle who had Down syndrome, who I was heavily involved in his care. And it was about 5 years ago all these things collided. And with respect to my uncle that really pulled the trigger, he was involved. There were a lot of various local nonprofit agencies that were providing services to him and other folks with developmental disabilities in our community. And there was a huge effort by both the state and federal government that were proposing significant funding cuts to these various nonprofit agencies that provided services. And my uncle and others like him, they didn't have a voice of their own, right? They couldn't speak and explain to anyone, really, how important these services are to them or were to them and what it would mean if there were the significant funding cuts. And so the various nonprofit agencies that were providing services would send out, you know, letters to all the family members and coordinated what, you know, we would refer to as a letter-writing campaign meeting. And we would meet, and I went to several of these. We'd meet in a large auditorium. Somebody would stand up and explain to all of us, you know, what the issues were. And they would hand us a form letter typed on a piece of paper and tell us to all go back home, figure out who our elected officials are, redo the form letter in our own handwriting, personalize it, and then either email it, fax it, or mail it to our elected politicians.
So that's a heavy lift. That's a lot of work. And so the idea basically is to simplify it, be able to make it easier for people.
For sure. So, you know, I left those meetings very discouraged, and I said, there's got to be a better way. I did my Google research.
And on the Michael Medved Show, back with you live on on November 17th, it's wind. Yes, we are having some wind storms in the Great Northwest, and for some reason that interrupted our connection. So I'm explaining everything to you. It's extremely anxiety producing, I've got to tell you, because sitting in my closet and trying to get the computer to go back up after, I don't know what the wind blew down exactly, but, and I was right in the middle of this encouraging, at least it is to me, segment based largely, but not exclusively, on a New York Times piece about how reality and the election had jarred liberals' vision of a united bloc. In other words, part of what they have been trying to put forward, and there's a powerful piece by Brett Stevens that we'll be talking about later, also in the New York Times. The left wants to put forward this idea of white supremacy and of the country being dominated by white supremacy. And part of the strategy is everybody who is non-white comes together automatically and does extraordinarily well. And one of the points that Brett Stevens points out in his piece is, look, President Trump lost the election, but he ran much more competitively than any of the polls indicated. For the second time in a row, his support was under-polled. And the other thing is, as he points out, for somebody who was regularly portrayed as the most anti-black, the most anti-immigrant, anti-Latino, anti-people of color president of recent history, he definitely increased his percentage of the black vote. He did. He increased it from 8% to 12%. Now, that's very far from being competitive, but it's a move in the right direction. And among Latinos and Asians, he also improved his vote. And one of the thing that things that Brett Stevens writes is, according to the incessant pronouncement of much of the news media, Donald Trump is the most anti-black and anti-Hispanic, anti-woman president in modern memory. Yet the CNN exit poll found that Trump won a majority of the vote of white women. And he did that both against Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. He also improved his vote share over 2016 with both Latino and black voters, while losing most of the advantage he previously had with college-educated white males, precisely the demographic his policies had supposedly done the most to favor. And look, this is one of those things when you actually do look at those exit polls, it is fascinating. The only way that Biden won is that he was more competitive with white voters, men and women, than Hillary was. And Trump was more competitive with voters of color. And that, it seems to me, is a very healthy thing. Because one of the things that Pew Research is writing about, they have this, and they tend to do these massive analyses, and they've done it again. And they write, America is exceptional in the nature of its political divide. And one of the things that they're talking about is something that was much more arguable before the election, which is the idea that basically our two parties are collections of different groups of people. But that's not the situation that happened. In other words, the Democratic Party is actually more white this time in terms of the votes that it took, and the Republican Party is more represented by people of color. And that is a very healthy thing, because once you claim that there is a political position that is mandated, that you're required to follow based upon your ethnic heritage or even based upon your place in the world, politics is about ideas. It's about issues. And one of the things that they write about is that one of the problems in America is that political identity trumps any other identity. You'll pardon the expression. Is that true? And what do we do about it? And what is it that a woman could say in a very persuasive book that would lead a leading people on the left to actually want to burn her book and ban it from places like Target? We'll get to that issue with Abigail Schreier and much more, and hopefully no technical interruptions, in this greatest nation on God's green earth.